To show cowardice with Caesar looking on and fighting alongside them seemed shameful, and for the man who fought well there stood the very witness who would also reward him. Already, it counted as a gain simply to be recognized by Caesar as brave. For this reason, many proved, through their eagerness, better than their own strength alone would have predicted. During these days, when the Jews had drawn up in a strong company before the wall and the two sides were still exchanging javelins at a distance, a certain Longinus, one of the cavalrymen, leapt out from the Roman ranks and plunged into the middle of the Jewish formation. As they scattered before his charge, he killed two of their bravest, striking one in the face as he came to meet him, and pulling out the spear from the first man, running the other through the side as he turned to flee, then dashed back to his own side from the midst of the enemy, unwounded. He became famous for this feat of courage, and many became eager rivals of his valor. The Jews, careless of their own suffering, thought only of inflicting harm, and death seemed lightest to them if it came together with the killing of an enemy. Titus, on the other hand, cared no less for the safety of his soldiers than for victory, calling reckless impulse mere madness, and holding that the only true courage was that joined with foresight, in which the man who acts suffers no harm. He ordered his men to show their manhood without needless risk to themselves. Titus himself then brought the battering ram up against the middle tower of the north wall, where a certain trickster among the Jews named Castor was lying in ambush with 10 companions, the rest having fled because of the archers. These men crouched behind the parapets for a while, keeping quiet, but when the tower began to give way, they rose up, and Castor, stretching out his hands as though begging for mercy, called out to Caesar, pleading in a piteous voice for them to be spared. Titus, believing him out of simple good faith and hoping the Jews were now ready to repent, halted the ram's blows and forbade his archers to shoot the suppliants, ordering them to ask Castor what he wanted. When Castor said he wished to come down under a pledge of safety, Titus replied that he was glad at his good sense, and would be glad if all the rest now felt the same way and were ready to give their pledge to the city. Of the 10 men, 5 joined Castor in pretending to plead for mercy, while the rest shouted that they would never submit to slavery as Romans when they could die free. As they argued at length among themselves, the assault stalled. Meanwhile, Castor sent word to Simon that he was deliberately delaying, saying that he himself was mocking the Roman command for no small stretch of time. Even as he sent this message, he could be seen openly urging on those who refused, calling them to come over to the right side. They, as though in outrage, drew their swords over the parapet, and striking their own breastplates, fell down as though they had cut their own throats. Astonishment seized Titus and those with him at the men's apparent courage, and being unable to see clearly from below what had actually happened, they admired their boldness and pitied their supposed suffering. Just then someone shot Castor with an arrow near the nose. He at once pulled it out and showed it to Titus, complaining that he was being treated unjustly. Angry at the archer, Caesar sent Josephus, who was standing nearby, to give Castor his right hand as a pledge. But Josephus said he would not go himself, since men who begged like this had nothing sound in mind, and he restrained those of his friends who were eager to go. A deserter named Aeneas, however, said he would go himself. When Castor called out that someone should also come to receive the money he was carrying with him, Aeneas ran up all the more eagerly, spreading out the fold of his cloak. Castor then picked up a stone and hurled it at him. Aeneas dodged and it missed him, but it wounded another soldier who had come forward. When Caesar realized the deception, he judged that showing mercy in war only did harm, since a harder attitude was less likely to fall victim to such trickery, and, angry at having been mocked, pressed the battering ram's blows against the tower all the harder. As the tower began to give way, Castor and his men set it on fire, and leaping through the flames into a hidden vault beneath it, they won a further reputation for courage among the Romans, who took it that they had thrown themselves into the fire. Caesar took this wall on the 5th day after the first, and when the Jews fled from it, he passed through with 1,000 armed men and his own picked troops, entering by the quarter where the wool market, the coppersmiths, and the clothes market of the new city stood, where the narrow streets ran obliquely toward the wall. Now, if Titus had either at once demolished more of the wall, or, entering under the law of war, ravaged what he had taken, I think no harm would have mixed with his victory. But as it was, hoping to win the Jews over by restraint when he could have done them damage by refusing to hold back, and wanting an easy way to retreat, he did not widen the breach he had made, for he did not expect that those he intended to treat kindly would plot against him. So when he entered, he allowed no one to be killed among those he captured, nor the houses to be burned. Instead, he offered the rebels, if they wished to keep fighting, a safe way out without harming the common people, and promised the people that their property would be preserved, for it mattered to him above all to save the city for himself and the temple for the city. The common people were ready to accept what he had long been urging on them, but to the fighting men, his generosity looked like weakness, and they supposed that Titus was offering these terms only because he was unable to take the rest of the city, threatening the townspeople with death if any of them so much as mentioned surrender, and cutting down anyone who spoke a word of peace. They attacked the Romans who had entered as well, some meeting them in the narrow streets, others from the houses, others still dashing out through the upper gates beyond the wall. Alarmed at this, the guards on the wall leapt down from the towers and withdrew to the camps. There was an uproar. Those inside the city, surrounded on every side by the enemy, and those outside, fearful for the men left behind. As the Jews kept growing in numbers and gained great advantage from their knowledge of the streets, they wounded many and drove the Romans back by sheer pressure. The Romans, for the most part, had no choice but to hold their ground, since the narrowness of the wall's opening made it impossible for them to flee altogether, and it seems all who had entered would have been cut down had Titus not come to their aid. Stationing archers at the tops of the narrow streets and taking his own stand at the point of thickest fighting, he held back the enemy with a barrage of missiles, and with him stood Domitius Sabinus, a brave man who also distinguished himself in this engagement. Caesar himself remained there, shooting continuously and keeping the Jews from advancing, until all his soldiers had withdrawn. Thus the Romans, having taken the second wall, were driven out of it again. The fighting men throughout the city grew bolder in spirit and were elated at their success, confident that the Romans would never again dare to enter the city, and that if they did, they themselves would not be defeated. For God had darkened their judgment because of their lawless deeds, and they could not see how much greater the Roman strength now was than the force they had just driven out, nor the famine creeping up on them, though for the moment there was still food to be had from the public miseries, and, as it were, the city's own blood to drink. Want had long since begun to grip the decent citizens, and many were perishing for lack of provisions. And neither would the Romans dare to force their way in again, nor would they themselves, if the Romans did, be beaten back, so they supposed. For God had darkened their minds because of their crimes, and they could not see how much greater the strength the Romans still had was than the strength that had been driven off, nor could they see the famine creeping up on them. For the time being there was still food to be had from the public misery, and the city's blood to drink. But want had long since been pressing on the decent, and through scarcity of provisions, many were breaking down. The destruction of the common people, the insurgents took as a relief to themselves, for they judged that only those deserved to survive who did not seek peace and had chosen to live in defiance of the Romans, and they were glad to see the opposing multitude wasting away like so much foreign rabble. Such was their disposition toward those within. Against the Romans, who tried once more to force an entry, they blocked the way, barricading the breach and defending the broken wall with their own bodies, and for 3 days they held out stubbornly. But on the fourth day, when Titus pressed the attack with vigor, they could not bear it and fled as they had before. He, master of the wall again, at once demolished the whole northern stretch of it, and posting garrisons in the towers along the southern section, turned his mind to attacking the third wall. Having decided to relax the siege for a little while and give the insurgents a period for deliberation, in case, after the fall of the second wall, they should relent, or in case fear of famine should move them, since, he reasoned, their plunder could not sustain them much longer, he put the respite to good use. For when the day came on which the soldiers' rations were due to be distributed, he ordered the officers to draw up the army in full view of the enemy and pay out the money to each man. And they, as was customary, uncovered the armor that had until then been kept hidden in its cases and marched forward fully armed, the cavalry leading their horses in all their finery. For a great distance, The ground before the city gleamed with silver and gold, and nothing in that spectacle was more delightful to their own side or more terrifying to the enemy. For the whole ancient wall was crowded with people gazing, and the northern quarter of the temple as well. The houses too were seen packed with those leaning out to look, and there was no part of the city that was not covered with the crowd. A dreadful consternation fell even on the boldest, as they saw the whole force gathered in one place and the splendor of the arms and the discipline of the men. And I think the insurgents would have been won over by that sight, had they not despaired of pardon from the Romans on account of the enormity of the wrongs they had done the people. Since punishment awaited them if they stopped, they judged death in war far preferable. And fate had its way, that the guiltless should perish along with the guilty, and the city along with the faction. For 4 days, then, the Romans continued bringing up rations, legion by legion. But on the fifth, when nothing peaceable came from the Jews, Titus divided his forces in two and began building earthworks against the Antonia and against John's monument, intending by the one to seize the upper city, and by the other the temple by way of the Antonia, for without taking that fort, holding the city itself would not be safe. At each of the 2 points, 2 mounds were raised, one for each legion. Those working near the monument were harassed by sallies of the Idumeans and Simon's armed men, those before the Antonia by John's men and the crowd of zealots. These had the advantage not only in hand-to-hand fighting, since they struck from higher ground, but by now had also learned to use the engines. Daily practice had gradually bred skill in them. They had 300 quick-firers and 40 stone-throwers, with which they made the building of the earthworks a hard business for the Romans. Titus, knowing that the city's survival or destruction rested on himself, pressed the siege hard, yet did not neglect to urge the Jews toward a change of heart, mixing persuasion with force. Often, recognizing that argument accomplishes more than weapons, he called on them himself to save themselves by surrendering a city already as good as taken, and he sent Josephus down to speak with them in their ancestral tongue, thinking they might yield to a man of their own people. Josephus went around the wall, taking care to stay out of range of missiles while still within earshot, and pleaded with them at length to spare themselves and the people, to spare their homeland and the temple, and not to show themselves more indifferent to these things than foreigners were. The Romans, he said, who have no share in them, respect the sanctities of their enemies and to this hour have held back their hands. But you, who were raised among these things, will, even if the city is saved, be the very ones left set on its destruction. You see with your own eyes that your stronger walls have fallen, and that what is left, the wall of those already conquered, is weaker still. And you know that Roman power is irresistible, and that servitude to them is nothing you have not already tasted. If indeed it is a fine thing to fight for freedom, that fight ought to have come at the beginning. But once one has submitted and yielded for so long a time, then to try to shake off the yoke is the act of men in love with a miserable death, not of lovers of freedom. One may rightly scorn masters who are inferior, not those to whom everything is already subject. What is there the Romans have not conquered, except perhaps something useless because of heat or cold? Fortune has passed over to them from every side, and God, who carries dominion around from nation to nation, is now over Italy. There is a law, too, fixed among beasts as among men, most powerful of all, to yield to the stronger and to let mastery rest with those who hold the edge in arms. It was for this reason that your ancestors, superior though they were in soul and in body and in every other resource, yielded to the Romans, which they would never have endured, had they not known that God was with them. And you, trusting in what do you hold out, when the greater part of the city is already taken, and those within, even if the walls still stand, are in a state worse than capture. For the Romans are not ignorant of the famine in the city, which is even now destroying the common people, and before long will destroy the fighting men too. Even if the Romans should stop the siege and not fall upon the city sword in hand, you have within you a war that cannot be fought off, one that feeds on you every hour, unless you can also take up arms against hunger and fight alone and master your own suffering. He added that it was a fine thing, before irreparable disaster, to change course and turn toward safety while it was still possible. For the Romans would bear them no grudge for what had happened, unless they persisted stubbornly to the end. By nature, the victor is merciful in the hour of triumph and sets advantage above anger. What served the Romans' advantage, he said, was neither an empty city nor a desolate land. That was why Caesar even now wished to offer them his right hand. For he would never save anyone by taking the city by force, least of all men who would not listen to persuasion even in their extremity. That the third wall would fall quickly was guaranteed by the walls already taken, and even if the fortification proved unbreakable, famine would fight on the Romans' side against them. As Josephus was urging this from the wall, many jeered at him, many cursed him, and some threw missiles. When he found that open counsel did not persuade them, he turned to the history of their own people, crying out, "Cowards, forgetful of your own allies, do you make war on the Romans with weapons and hands? Whom else have we ever defeated in that way? When has God, who created us, not avenged the Jews when they were wronged? Will you not stop and see from where you launched this fight, and how great an ally you have defiled? Will you not remember the miraculous deeds of your fathers, and how great wars this holy place once put down for us? I myself shudder to speak of the works of God before unworthy ears, yet hear them still, so that you may know you are at war not only with the Romans, but with God himself. Necho, king of Egypt at that time, the same man was also called Pharaoh, came down with a vast force and seized Sarah, the queen, mother of our race. What then did her husband Abraham, our forefather, do? Did he avenge the outrage with weapons, though he had 318 captains under him, and under each of them a force beyond counting? Or did he not rather judge them a mere desert without God's presence, and, raising pure hands toward this very ground you have now defiled, enlist him as an ally none could conquer? Before a single evening had passed, the queen was sent back to her husband unstained, while the Egyptian, bowing before ground you have bloodied with kindred murder and trembling at visions in the night, fled, showering the God-beloved Hebrews with silver and gold. Shall I speak of our father's migration into Egypt? For 400 years, tyrannized and subjected to foreign kings, though it was in their power to defend themselves with weapons and their own hands, they entrusted themselves instead to God. Who does not know how Egypt was filled with every kind of beast and ruined by every disease, its land barren, its Nile failing, the 10 plagues one after another? And how because of all this our fathers were sent on their way under guard, unbloodied, unharmed, whom God led forth as his own attendants? And when the sacred ark was seized by the Syrians, did not Philistia groan, and Dagon the idol, and every nation of those who had seized it groaned as well, their inward parts rotting and, through them, their very bowels falling away along with their food, until with the same hands that had plundered it they carried it back, propitiating the holy thing with the sound of cymbals and drums and every sort of offering? It was God who commanded these things for our fathers, because, laying aside their hands and their weapons, they entrusted him to judge the matter. When Sennacherib, king of the Assyrians, dragging all Asia behind him, encamped around this very city, did it fall by human hands? Were not the hands that should have wielded weapons instead still, occupied in prayer, while an angel of God in a single night destroyed that immense army, so that the Assyrian, rising the next day, found 185,000 corpses and fled with the survivors, unarmed and unpursued by the Hebrews? You know too of the captivity in Babylon, where our people, exiled for 70 years, did not shake themselves free into liberty until Cyrus granted it as a gift to God. Escorted forth by him, they restored once more the worship of their ally. To speak generally, there is nothing our fathers ever achieved by weapons, and nothing they failed to achieve when they left the matter to God instead. Staying in their place, they conquered, as it seemed good to their judge. Fighting, they always stumbled. Take the time the king of the Babylonians besieged this very city. Our king Zedekiah, engaging him against the prophecies of Jeremiah, was himself taken captive, and saw the city, along with the temple, razed to the ground. And yet how much more moderate was that king than your leaders now, and his people than yours? When Jeremiah cried aloud that they were hateful to God because of their offenses against him, and would be taken unless they surrendered the city, neither the king nor the people put him to death for it. But you, to say nothing of what goes on within your own walls, for I could not adequately describe your lawlessness. You curse and stone me for urging you toward safety, provoked by the mere mention of your sins, unable even to bear hearing of deeds you commit with your own hands every day. Or take the time when Antiochus, called Epiphanes, sat before this city, having committed many outrages against the divine. Our ancestors then went out with weapons and were themselves cut down in the battle. The city was plundered by the enemy, and the sanctuary lay desolate for 3 years and 6 months. And why need I say more? Who enlisted the Romans against this nation, if not the impiety of its own people? Where did our servitude begin, if not in the discord of our ancestors, when the madness of Aristobulus and Hyacinus and their rivalry with each other brought Pompey against the city, and God subjected to the Romans a people unworthy of freedom? Besieged for 3 months, they surrendered themselves, though they had not sinned against the sanctuary and the laws as you have, and though they had far greater resources for war. And you know the end of Antigonus, son of Aristobulus, in whose reign God once more drove the sinning people to capture. Herod, son of Antipater, brought Sosius, and Sosius brought a Roman army, and surrounded, they were besieged for 6 months, until, paying the penalty for their sins, they were taken and the city was plundered by the enemy. So it has never been given to this nation to prevail by arms. War and capture go together for it always. For those who dwell on holy ground must, I think, leave everything to God's judgment and despise recourse to human hands only when they have first won over the judge above. As for you, what of the things the lawgiver blessed have you done? What of the things he cursed have you left undone? How much more impious are you than those who fell so much sooner? You have not merely disgraced yourselves with hidden sins, theft, I mean, and treachery and adultery. You compete in open plunder and murder, and invent strange new paths of wickedness. And the temple has become the receptacle for it all, and hands of your own kindred have defiled that divine place, which even the Romans venerated from afar, setting aside many of their own customs out of respect for your law. And after this, do you expect the ally you have wronged to help you? You are indeed righteous suppliants, calling on your helper with clean hands. With hands like yours, our king once made supplication against the Assyrian, when God laid low that great army in a single night. Do the Romans act as the Assyrian did, that you should hope for a like deliverance? He, having taken money from our king on condition that he would not sack the city, came down in violation of his oaths to burn the temple. The Romans ask only the customary tribute our fathers paid to theirs. Once they receive it, they neither sack the city nor touch the sanctuaries, but grant you everything else, the free enjoyment of your families and your possessions, and they preserve your sacred laws. It is madness, then, to expect God's help for men who are, as clearly as he had against the unjust, and he knows how to defend at once, whenever there is need. He crushed the Assyrians on the very first night they camped against us. So if he had judged our people worthy of freedom, or the Romans worthy of punishment, he would have struck at once, just as he did the Assyrians. When Pompey laid hands on our nation, when Sosius marched up after him, when Vespasian was ravaging Galilee, and now last of all, when Titus was approaching the city. And yet Pompey the Great and Sosius, far from suffering any harm, took the city by force, and Vespasian rose to kingship out of his war against us. For Titus even the springs run more abundantly, though they had dried up for you before. You know that before his arrival the Siloam failed, and all the springs outside the city, so that water had to be bought by the jar. But now they flow so plentifully for your enemies that they suffice not only for them and their animals, but even for their gardens. Indeed, you have already experienced this same portent once before, at the earlier capture of the city, when the Babylonian I mentioned marched against us, and, taking the city, burned it and the temple, though I think none of those who committed impiety then did so on the scale you have. So I believe that the divine has fled from the sanctuary and now stands beside those you are fighting. Yet a good man will flee a shameless household and hate those in it. And do you still believe that God stays beside your own crimes, he who sees all hidden things and hears what is kept silent? But what is kept silent among you, or what is hidden? What has not become plain even to your enemies? You parade your lawlessness in public and vie with one another day by day over who can become worse, making a display of injustice as though it were virtue. Even so, a path to safety still remains if you are willing, and the divine is easily reconciled to those who confess and repent. O men of iron, throw down your weapons. Take pity, even now, on a fatherland already crumbling into ruin. Turn and look at the beauty you are betraying. What a city, what a temple, the gifts of how many nations. Does anyone lead a torch against these things? Does anyone wish these to exist no longer? And what is worthier of being saved than these, you who are unmoved and harder than stones? And if you cannot look on these things with honest eyes, at least pity your own families. Let each of you picture his children, his wife, his parents, whom before long famine or war will consume. I know that my own mother shares this danger, and my wife, and a family not without distinction, a house once illustrious, and perhaps you think I counsel you for their sake. Kill them, then. Take my blood as the price of your own salvation. I too am ready to die, if after me you will come to your senses. While Josephus was crying out these things in tears, the rebels neither yielded nor judged a change of course safe, but the common people were moved toward desertion. Some sold their possessions for next to nothing. Others swallowed their gold coins, the most valuable of their treasures, so as not to be caught by the brigands, and then deserted to the Romans, and once they had passed the gold, they had ample means for whatever they needed. For Titus let most of them go free into the countryside, wherever each wished, and this very fact drew them all the more to desertion, since they would be spared the miseries within the city and would not become slaves to the Romans. But John and Simon's men watched for people leaving even more closely than for the Romans entering, and anyone who gave the mere shadow of suspicion was killed on the spot. For the wealthy, even staying was as good as death, since a man could be put to death on the pretext of desertion for the sake of his property. As the famine grew, the recklessness of the rebels grew with it, and both horrors flared up worse each day. Grain was nowhere to be seen openly. They would burst into houses and search them, and if they found any, they tortured the occupants for having denied having it, and if they found none, they tortured them for having hidden it all the more carefully. The proof of whether the wretched had food or not was their bodies. Those who still held themselves together were assumed to have plenty, while those already wasting away were passed over, since it seemed pointless to kill people who were about to die of starvation anyway. Many secretly traded their whole estates for a single measure of grain, of wheat, if they happened to be wealthier, or of barley, if poorer, then shut themselves up in the innermost recesses of their houses. Some, in the extremity of their want, ate the grain unprocessed, while others baked it as necessity and fear dictated. Nowhere was a table set. Instead, people snatched the food half-cooked from the fire and devoured it. The meal was pitiable, and the sight of it worthy of tears, as the stronger took more than their share, and the weak wept. Famine overpowers every other suffering, but nothing does it destroy so completely as shame. What would otherwise deserve respect is despised under its power. Wives snatched food from their husbands, children from their fathers, and most pitiable of all, mothers from their own infants' mouths, and even as their dearest wasted away in their arms, they showed no mercy in stripping from them the very drops of life. Even so, eating this way did not go unnoticed. The rebels were posted everywhere, ready to seize even this. Whenever they saw a house shut up, they took it as a sign that those inside were taking food, and at once they broke down the doors and burst in, all but squeezing the morsels back up out of people's throats. Old men were beaten as they clung to their food, and women were dragged by the hair as they tried to conceal what was in their hands. There was no pity for gray hair or for infants. They would lift children clean off the ground, still clinging to their scraps of bread, and dash them to the floor. Toward those who had gotten ahead of their raid and swallowed down what would have been seized, they turned crueler still, as though wronged. They devised terrible methods of torture in their search for food, stuffing bitter vetch into the private passages of the wretched, driving sharp stakes up through their bowels. A man suffered things horrible even to hear of, merely to confess to one loaf of bread or to reveal a single handful of hidden barley meal. Yet the torturers themselves were not hungry. That at least would have made the cruelty less monstrous, being done from necessity. Rather, they were exercising their own recklessness, and stocking up provisions for the days ahead. As for those who crept out at night, past the Roman guard posts to gather wild greens and grass, the rebels would waylay them just when they thought they had already escaped the enemy, and snatch away what they had brought back. And though these people often begged them, invoking the dread name of God, to share some part of what they had risked their lives to gather, they would not give up so much as a scrap. A man was fortunate merely not to be killed on top of being robbed. Such was what the lowly suffered at the hands of the guardsmen, but those of rank and wealth were brought before the tyrants themselves. Some of these were destroyed on false charges of plotting, others on the charge of betraying the city to the Romans. The readiest device of all was a suborned informer who claimed they had resolved to desert. A man stripped bare by Simon would be sent up to John, and a man plundered by John would be handed over in turn to Simon. They toasted each other, so to speak, with the blood of the citizens, and divided between them the corpses of the wretched. Over dominance, there was rivalry between the two, but in impiety, there was perfect harmony. Whichever of them failed to share the fruits of another's ruin with his rival was thought simply mean, and whichever was denied his share grieved over the loss, as though cheated of some good. The loss, that is, of a share in cruelty. It is impossible to go through their lawlessness point by point. To put it briefly, no other city has ever suffered such things, and no generation since the beginning of time has been more fertile in wickedness. In the end, they even disown the very race of the Hebrews, so as to seem less impious toward foreigners, and confess themselves to be what in truth they were, slaves, a rabble, the bastard refuse of the nation. It was they themselves who overthrew the city. They forced the unwilling Romans to be credited with a grim achievement, and all but dragged the fire, in its slowness, onto the temple. Indeed, watching it burn from the upper city, they felt no grief and shed no tears. It was among the Romans that these feelings were found. But of this we shall speak later, in its proper place, with the facts to prove it. Meanwhile, Titus's earthworks were advancing, although his soldiers were suffering heavy losses from the wall. He also sent a detachment of cavalry with orders to lie in ambush for those who went out through the ravines to gather food. Among these foragers were some fighting men no longer sustained by plunder. But for the most part, they were poor people from the populace, kept from deserting by fear for their families. They had no hope of escaping the rebels' notice if they fled with wives and children, and they could not bear to leave them behind to be slaughtered by the brigands on their account. Hunger made them bold enough to go out, but the only outcome left to them, once they had eluded their own countrymen, was to be captured by the enemy. When caught, they resisted out of necessity, and once a fight had begun, it seemed too late to beg for mercy. So, after being scourged and subjected to every torment short of death, they were crucified opposite the wall. To Titus, this suffering appeared pitiable, since as many as 500 were being captured each day, sometimes more. Yet he saw that it was not safe to release those taken by force, and that guarding so many would itself require a garrison of guards. All the same, he did not stop it, mainly, I think, in the hope that the sight of it might induce the people to surrender, on the understanding that if they did not, they would suffer the same fate. Out of anger and hatred, the soldiers nailed up those they caught, one in this posture and another in that, for mockery's sake, and so great was their number that space ran out for the crosses and crosses for the bodies. So far were the rebels from being moved by this suffering that they turned it, quite to the contrary, into a device against the rest of the populace. Dragging the relatives of deserters up onto the wall, along with any of the common people inclined to trust in surrender, they displayed to them what befell those who fled to the Romans, calling the captured men suppliants, not prisoners. This held back many of those who had been inclined to desert, until the truth became known, though there were some who fled all the more quickly precisely because they took it for certain punishment, considering death at the enemy's hands a relief compared with famine. Titus also ordered many of those captured to have their hands cut off, and then sent them back in, so that they would not be taken for deserters and would be believed on account of their misfortune, urging Simon and John to stop at this point, and not force him to destroy the city, but rather, through a last-minute change of heart, to save their own lives, and so great a homeland, and a temple shared with no other people. Going around the earthworks, he at the same time urged on the workers, as one who would soon back up his words with deeds. In response, they blasphemed him from the wall, and his father too, shouting that they scorned death, for they had nobly chosen it over slavery, and that they would do the Romans all the harm they could as long as they had breath, that they cared nothing for a fatherland which, as he himself said, was doomed to perish, and that the world was a finer temple for God than this one, once it too had perished. Yet even this temple, they said, would be saved by the one who dwelt in it, and having him as their ally, they would mock every threat that lagged behind its fulfillment in action, for the outcome belonged to God. Such were the things they shouted, mingled with abuse. Meanwhile, Antiochus Epiphanes also arrived, with a considerable body of other heavy infantry as well as, around himself, a unit called the Macedonians. All of an age, tall, just past boyhood, armed and trained in the Macedonian manner, from which they took their name, though most of them fell short of that lineage. For it happened that the king of Comagene was, before he tasted a reversal of fortune, the most fortunate of all the kings under Roman rule. But he too demonstrated in his old age that no man should be called blessed before death. But his son, present there at the height of his powers at that time, said he was amazed that the Romans should hesitate at all to approach the wall. He was himself something of a warrior, reckless by nature, and so formidable in strength that his daring fell short of disaster only by a narrow margin. When Titus smiled and said that the labor of it was open to all, Antiochus, just as he was, charged toward the wall with his Macedonians. He himself, thanks to his strength and skill, guarded against the Jewish missiles by shooting arrows at them. But all his young men except a few were cut down, for out of shame at their boast they kept fighting on, determined not to be outdone. In the end, many withdrew wounded, reflecting that even true Macedonians, if they meant to conquer, needed the fortune of Alexander. For the Romans, who had begun on the 12th of the month Artemisius, the earthworks were finished only with difficulty on the 29th, after 17 days of continuous labor. Four enormous ramps were raised. One, against the Antonia, was thrown up by the 5th Legion in the middle of the pool called Struthius. The other was raised by the 12th Legion, about 20 cubits away from it. The 10th Legion's work was at a considerable distance from these, on the northern side, near the pool called Amygdalon. And the 15th Legion's ramp stood about 30 cubits from that one, by the monument of the high priest. As the ramps were now being brought forward, John, tunneling from inside as far as the earthworks at the Antonia, propped up the mines with timbers and so suspended the ramps above them. He then brought in wood smeared with pitch and bitumen and set it alight. When the props burned through, the tunnel collapsed all at once, and with a tremendous crash, the earthworks caved in upon it. At first, along with the dust, thick smoke rose up, since the fire was being smothered by the falling debris. But once the timber pressing down on it had been consumed, a clear flame burst out. The Romans were struck with shock at the suddenness of it, and with dismay at the ingenuity behind it. Just when they thought themselves on the verge of victory, this event chilled their hope for the future as well, since fighting the fire seemed useless. Even if it were put out, the earthworks had already been swallowed up. 2 days later, Simon's men attacked the other earthworks as well. For the Romans, having brought up their siege engines there, were now battering the wall. A certain Tephtheus from the city of Garus in Galilee, and Magaseros, a servant of the royal household of Mariam, together with a certain man of Adiabene, son of Nabateus, called by that name from his fortune and his lameness, Agiras meaning lame, seized torches and dashed forward ahead of the rest, against the siege engines. Of these men, none showed themselves either bolder or more formidable in the whole course of the war than these who came out of the city. For they rushed at the enemy's ranks, as though running to greet friends rather than charging a hostile mass, neither hesitating nor drawing back, but leaping straight through the midst of their foes and setting fire to the siege engines. Though struck by missiles and pressed back with swords from every side, they would not be driven from the danger until they had seized hold of the fire consuming the machines. As the flame now rose, the Romans came running up from their camps to help, while the Jews from the wall hindered them, grappling with those who tried to put the fire out and sparing none of their own bodies in the struggle. Some men were dragging the siege engines out of the fire even as the wicker screens above them were already burning, while the Jews, reaching through the very flames, seized hold of the red-hot iron rams and would not let them go. The fire spread from these to the earthworks themselves and overtook the defenders before they could react. At this point, the Romans, surrounded by the flame and despairing of saving their works, withdrew to their camps, while the Jews pressed after them, their numbers ever growing as reinforcements came out from within, and, emboldened by their success, gave free rein to their fury, advancing all the way to the Roman fortifications and their closing with the guards. There is a picket that stands in relief before the camp, and there is a fearsome Roman law that condemns to death whoever abandons his post for any reason whatsoever. These men, choosing a death with honor over one with disgrace, stood their ground, and by their example, many of those who had turned to flee were shamed into turning back. Meanwhile, the arrow throwers had been set up along the wall and were holding back the crowd still pouring out of the city, men who gave no thought at all to their own safety or protection. For the Jews closed with whomever they met, and hurling themselves recklessly onto the enemy's spear points, struck down their foes with their own bodies. Yet they prevailed by their daring far more than by any real advantage in strength, just as the Romans yielded more to their boldness than to the harm they were actually taking. By now Titus had arrived from the Antonia, where he had gone apart to survey ground for further earthworks, and after sharply rebuking his soldiers for endangering their own fortifications when they already held the walls of the enemy, and for themselves enduring, as it were, the fate of the besieged by loosing the Jews upon themselves as if from a prison, he himself went round with a picked force to attack the enemy's flank. The Jews, struck now from the front and turning to face him too, held firm nonetheless. Once the battle lines had mingled together, dust overwhelmed the eyes and the shouting overwhelmed the ears, and neither side could any longer tell friend from foe. The Jews held their ground no longer so much by strength as by despair of any other safety, while the Romans were spurred on by shame before their reputation and their arms, and by Caesar himself risking danger in the front line. So that, in my judgment, the excess of their fury would even have driven them to sweep away the whole Jewish force, had the Jews not anticipated the turning of the battle and withdrawn into the city in time. With the earthworks destroyed, the Romans were in despair, having lost in a single hour the fruit of long and heavy labor, and many, considering their familiar siege engines gone, gave up hope of ever taking the city. Titus took counsel with his officers. The more impetuous urged bringing the whole force to bear at once and attempting the wall by main force. For until now, they argued, the fighting had been only in scattered clashes with the Jews. But if the troops advanced in a single mass, the Jews would not be able to withstand even the assault, since they would be overwhelmed by the sheer volume of missiles. Those inclined to greater caution advised either building the earthworks again, or else, foregoing that, simply sitting down before the city and closely guarding both its exits and the bringing in of supplies, so as to abandon the city to famine and avoid hand-to-hand fighting with the enemy altogether. For men in despair, they said, are unconquerable, since for them it is a matter of prayer to fall by the sword, while apart from that a still crueler fate awaits them regardless. Titus himself judged it beneath him to remain wholly idle with so great a force at his disposal, yet thought it pointless to fight men who would in any case destroy one another. And he pointed out that building earthworks was made difficult by the scarcity of timber, while guarding the exits was harder still, since surrounding so vast and difficult a city with his army was no easy matter, and was besides risky against sudden sorties. And even were the open routes guarded, the Jews, driven by necessity and aided by their familiarity with the ground, would contrive hidden paths, and if any provisions were smuggled in even secretly, it would only prolong the siege. He feared, moreover, that the length of time involved might diminish the glory of his eventual success. For while time can accomplish anything, it is speed that wins renown. If then he wished to combine speed with safety, he must wall in the entire city. Only in this way could every exit be blocked, and the Jews, despairing utterly of any deliverance, would either surrender the city or, weakened by famine, be overpowered with ease. For he himself, he said, would not remain inactive in the meantime either, but would set about the earthworks again, using less exposed methods this time. And if to anyone the undertaking seemed too vast and difficult to accomplish, he should consider that it is not fitting for Romans to attempt anything on a small scale, and that no great achievement comes easily to anyone without toil. Having persuaded his officers with these arguments, he ordered the forces to be distributed for the work. A kind of superhuman zeal seized the soldiers, and as they divided the circuit of the wall among themselves, rivalry arose not only between the legions, but between the individual units within them, and each soldier strove to win the favor of his squad leader. The squad leader that of his centurion, the centurion in turn was eager to please his tribune, the ambition of the tribunes reached toward the legates, and Caesar himself presided over the rivalry of the legates. For he went about in person, several times each day, inspecting the work. Beginning from the camp of the Assyrians where he himself was quartered, he carried the wall down toward the lower new city, then from there through the Kidron Valley up to the Mount of Olives. Turning south from there, he encompassed the mountain as far as the rock called the Dovecotes and the hill next to it that overlooks the ravine by Siloam, and from there, bending westward, he descended into the Valley of the Spring. From there, climbing up past the tomb of the high priest Ananus and taking in the hill where Pompey had once encamped, he turned toward the north, and advancing as far as a village called the House of the Chickpea Sellers, and beyond it the tomb of Herod, he brought the line round to the east until it joined his own camp, where it had begun. The wall thus built came to 39 furlongs in length, and 13 forts were built along its outer face, whose combined circuits added up to 10 more furlongs. The whole was completed in 3 days, so that a work that should by rights have taken months was finished at a speed that strained belief. Having enclosed the city with this wall and stationed troops in the forts, Titus himself went round inspecting the first watch of the night, entrusted the second to Alexander, and the third fell to the legionary commanders. The guards cast lots for their turns of sleep, and throughout the whole night men made their rounds along the intervals between the forts. For the Jews, with every avenue closed off, all hope of deliverance was now cut off, and the famine, deepening its hold, devoured the population household by household and family by family. The rooftops were filled with women and infants wasting away, the alleys with the corpses of the old. Children and young men, swollen with hunger, wandered the marketplaces like ghosts and collapsed wherever the affliction overtook them. Those still able could not bury their own relatives, and even the strong shrank from the task, both because of the sheer number of the dead and because of the uncertainty of their own fate. For many died even as they were burying others, and many made their way to the burial grounds before their appointed hour had come. There was no wailing amid these calamities, nor any lamentation, for the famine stifled all such feeling. With dry eyes and grinning mouths, those in the agony of death looked on at those who had gone ahead of them into rest, and a deep silence enveloped the city, and a night heavy with death. And yet more terrible than these horrors were the bandits. Breaking into houses to plunder the dead, they stripped the coverings from the bodies and went out laughing, testing the edges of their swords on the corpses. Some of those thrown out they even ran through while still alive, just to try the blade. Those who begged to be granted a sword and a hand to end their suffering they left, in scorn, to the famine instead, and each of the dying, fixing his eyes on the temple as he expired, looked his last upon it, leaving the rebels alive behind him. At first the rebels ordered the dead to be buried at public expense, unable to bear the stench. But afterward, when this proved beyond their means, they simply threw the bodies from the walls into the ravines. When Titus, going round these ravines, saw them choked with the dead and a deep, rotting ooze seeping out from the decaying bodies, he groaned aloud, and raising his hands, called God to witness that this was not his doing. Such, then, was the state of affairs within the city. As for the Romans, since none of the rebels any longer sallied out, for by now despair and famine were gripping them as well, they passed the time in good spirits, having an abundance of grain and other provisions brought from Syria and the neighboring provinces. Many stood near the wall displaying quantities of food, and by their own satisfaction inflamed the hunger of the enemy all the more. But since the sufferings of the rebels bent them not at all, Titus, pitying the remnant of the people, and eager to save at least those who were left, set about building earthworks once more, though timber was now hard to procure for him. For all the timber around the city had already been cut down in the earlier operations, so the soldiers had to bring in fresh supplies from a distance of 90 furlongs. And it was only against the Antonia now that earthworks were raised, in 4 sections, each far larger than the earlier ones. Caesar went round the legions, urging on the work and showing the rebels that he already held them in his grasp. But it seems that for these men alone all capacity for remorse had perished, for they had separated their souls from their bodies and treated both as if they belonged to someone else. No suffering could soften their spirit, nor did any pain touch their flesh, these men who tore at the corpses of the people like dogs and filled the prisons with the sick. Simon, for instance, did not spare even Matthias, the very man through whom he had gained control of the city, but had him put to torture before killing him. This Matthias was the son of Boethus, one of the chief priests, a man especially trusted and honored by the people. When the populace was being abused by the zealots, whom by then John had joined, he persuaded the people to let Simon in to help them, entering into no prior agreement with him and expecting nothing base from him. But when Simon came in and made himself master of the city, he counted the very man who had championed his cause an enemy just like all the rest, as though the deed had sprung from mere simplicity of mind. Brought before him now and accused of favoring the Romans, Simon condemned him to death, without even granting him a hearing, along with three of his sons. His fourth son had managed to slip away beforehand to Titus. Matthias begged to be killed before his children, asking this one favor in return for having opened the city gate to Simon, but Simon ordered him killed last of all. So the father was slaughtered in full view of his slain sons, led forward directly opposite the Romans. For it was in this way that Simon ordered Ananus, son of Bagadates, the most brutal of his bodyguards, to carry it out, mocking Matthias with the taunt of whether those Romans he had chosen to go over to would come to help him now. He forbade, moreover, that the bodies be buried. After these, a priest named Ananias, son of Masbellus, one of the notables, and Aristeus the secretary of the council, a man of Emmaus, and with them 15 other prominent men of the people were put to death. Josephus's father they shut up under guard, and they proclaimed that no one in the city should either speak with him or gather together with anyone else, for fear of treachery, and they killed on the spot, without any inquiry, those who so much as joined in mourning together. Seeing this, a certain Judas son of Judas, one of Simon's officers, entrusted by him with the guard of a tower, moved partly, perhaps, by pity for those being so cruelly destroyed, but still more by concern for his own safety, called together the 10 men he trusted most among those under his command, and said, "How long shall we go on enduring these evils? What hope of safety do we have if we remain loyal to a villain? Is not famine already upon us, the Romans very nearly within our walls, and Simon faithless even toward his own benefactors? Is there not already the fear of punishment from him, while a Roman pledge of good faith stands firm? Come, then, let us hand over the wall and save ourselves and the city. Simon will suffer nothing dreadful if, despairing of himself, he surrenders sooner rather than later." When 10 of his men had been won over by this argument, toward dawn he sent the rest of those under him off in various directions, so that none of what had been planned would be discovered, while he himself, about the third hour, called out to the Romans from the tower. Some of the Romans scorned the offer, some disbelieved it, and most held back, expecting to take the city without risk before long anyway. And while Titus was on his way toward the wall with a body of armed men, Simon, learning of the plot in time, swiftly seized the tower first, arrested the men, and, in full view of the Romans, put them to death before the wall, mutilating the bodies before throwing them down. Meanwhile, Josephus, going about as he did without ever ceasing his appeals, was struck on the head by a stone and fell at once, stunned. The Jews made a rush out to seize the fallen body, and he would soon have been dragged into the city had Caesar not quickly sent men to shield him. While these were fighting, Josephus was carried off, barely conscious of what was happening around him, and the rebels, believing they had killed the man they most wished dead, cried out for joy. Word of it spread through the city, and despair gripped the people left behind, who were now convinced that the man because of whom they had dared to think of deserting was truly gone. When Josephus's mother heard in prison that her son was dead, she told the guards from Jotapata that she had believed this all along, since she had gained nothing even from his being alive. But privately, lamenting to her handmaids, she said that this was the fruit she had reaped from bearing a fine son, not even to be able to bury him, the very man from whom she had expected to be buried herself. Yet neither did this false report grieve her for long, nor did it warm the hearts of the rebels for long either. For Josephus quickly recovered from the blow, and, coming forward, cried out that before long he would make them pay for the wound, and once more called on the people to keep faith with the Romans. His appearance struck courage into the people and dismay into the rebels alike. As for the deserters, some leapt down quickly from the wall out of sheer necessity, while others went out as if to fight, armed with stones, and then fled over to the Romans. But a fate crueler than what they had left behind awaited these men, and they found the Roman abundance a swifter road to ruin than the famine within had been. For they arrived swollen from deprivation, as if dropsical, and then, gorging their shrunken bodies all at once, burst apart. All except those who, from experience, husbanded their appetites and fed their bodies, unaccustomed as they were to nourishment, only gradually. And even those who survived in this way soon fell prey to a different affliction, for among the he kept inviting the people once more to trust him. At the sight of him, courage fell upon the people and terror upon the rebels. Of the deserters, some, driven by necessity, leapt quickly from the wall, others went forward as if to fight, hurling stones, and then fled to the Romans. But a fate harsher than the one within followed them there, and they found the surfeit among the Romans a swifter road to ruin than the famine at home. For they arrived swollen from want, as if dropsical, and then, gorging their empty bodies all at once, burst apart. All but those who, through experience, rationed their appetites and gave their bodies, unused to it, food little by little. Yet even those who survived in this way met with a second blow. One of the deserters among the Syrians was caught picking gold coins out of the filth of his own bowels. For the deserters had taken to swallowing coins before they came out, since the rebels searched everyone, and there was a great quantity of gold in the city. A coin that had fetched 12 Attic drachmas before now fetched 25. But once this device was exposed through one man, a rumor spread through the camps that the deserters were arriving full of gold, and the horde of Arabs and the Syrians cut open the suppliants and searched their bellies. I do not think any calamity befell the Jews more terrible than this one. In a single night, close to 2,000 were ripped open. When Titus learned of this lawlessness, he came close to surrounding the guilty men with cavalry and cutting them down with javelins, and would have done so had not so vast a number been implicated, far more than could be punished. He called together the commanders of the allies and of the legions, for some of his own soldiers too were charged in the affair, and told them he was angry at both parties alike, that some of the men serving with him should do such things for the sake of uncertain gain, with no shame even for their own weapons, worked as they were in silver and gold, and that the Arabs and Syrians, indulging their passions at will in a war not their own, should then charge the Romans with the guilt of their butchery and their hatred of the Jews, when even now some of his own soldiers were sharing in the ill repute of it. To these he threatened death, should anyone be found daring the same thing again, and he ordered the men of the legions to search out any under suspicion and bring them before him. But love of money, it seems, held every punishment in contempt, and the desire for gain is planted deep and fierce in men, and no passion rivals greed. Or rather, such things elsewhere have their measure and yield to fear. But here it was God who had condemned the whole people, and who was turning every path to safety into a path to destruction. At any rate, what Caesar had forbidden under threat of death was still ventured against the deserters in secret. Before they could be seen by all, the barbarians ran ahead of them and cut them down, watching all the while lest any Roman catch sight of it, then slit them open and drew the vile prophet out of their entrails. It was found on few, and hope alone destroyed the many. This calamity did at least bring many of the deserters back inside. John, once the people had nothing left to plunder, turned to sacrilege. He melted down many of the dedicated offerings of the temple, and many of the vessels needed for the sacred services, mixing bowls, platters, and tables, nor did he spare even the wine vessels sent by Augustus and his wife. For while the emperors of Rome had always honored and adorned the temple, this Jew now tore down even what foreigners had given it. He told those around him that men must make free use of sacred things on behalf of the sacred, without fear, and that those who fought for the temple should be fed from it. For this reason, he emptied out the sacred oil and the wine which the priests kept in store for the whole burnt offerings, kept there in the inner sanctuary, and distributed it among the people, who anointed themselves with it, and drank it without a shudder. I would not hold back from saying what my feelings compel me to say. I believe that had the Romans delayed in coming against these wretches, either the city would have been swallowed by a chasm, or drowned by a flood, or struck by the thunderbolts that fell on Sodom, for it produced a generation far more godless than those who suffered such fates. Through the madness of these men, the whole people perished together. Why should I recount the calamities one by one? In those days, a man named Manius, son of Lazarus, fled to Titus and reported that through a single gate entrusted to his charge, 115,880 corpses had been carried out. From the day Titus had encamped before them, the 14th of the month Xanthicus, to the new moon of Painmas. This was the number of the poor alone. He himself did not stand watch there of his own will, but was paid by the public to keep the count, out of necessity. The rest of the dead their families buried, and burial meant only carrying the body out of the city and casting it down. After him, many notable men who deserted reported that in all 600,000 of the poor had been thrown out through the gates, and that the number of the rest was beyond counting. When they no longer had the strength to carry the poor out, they said, the bodies were heaped up in the largest houses, and the houses shut up. A measure of grain, they said, sold for a talent. And later, once the city had been walled all around, and it was no longer even possible to gather weeds, some were driven by need to such extremes that they searched the sewers and old cattle dung and ate the refuse found there. And what had once not even been bearable to look at now became food. The Romans, hearing this, were moved to pity. But the rebels, even seeing it with their own eyes, felt no repentance and endured it, waiting until it should reach them too. For they had been blinded already by the ruin that stood over both the city and themselves.